petrol or electric? Petrol or electric? Why choose? Petrol and electric. Discover the BMW plug-in hybrid range. Visit your BMW retailer or find out more at bmw.ie. Sometimes electric, always BMW.
It's Wednesday, July the 7th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan, revived and refreshed after my fortnight in the intermittently sunny northwest. Thanks to Harry McGee and to Pat Leahy for minding the shop in my absence. And indeed, Pat is here again with us today, along with his politics team colleague, Cormac McQuinn. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome.
Hi, Hugh.
Top of the morning to you, Hugh. You look relaxed and refreshed, and maybe even a little bronzed after your time in Donegal.
Yes, well, wind-whipped perhaps a little more than bronze. But anyway, also here is our health editor, Paul Cullen. And Paul, I'm going to go to you first, if you don't mind, because observing events over the last couple of weeks from the Atlantic seaboard, there seems to be an awful lot of confusion. And I don't know if messing is the right word, but decision-making on the hoof in relation to the approach to COVID over the next month or so.
I suppose the first thing to say is we have a very complicated decision-making process anyway. So a lot of different people involved, a lot of different actors, some of them very leaky. So you get a kind of a messy decision-making process. The second thing is the situation with regard to the virus is just not very clear. As you know, we're in a state of flux. We're moving on to a new variant, which seems to be more infectious, and is becoming dominant here, or it is dominant, or it's heading towards 90% or whatever. So we're facing a new challenge, and therefore all the previous sums have to be torn up. We don't have much to go on. And then when you look at other countries, there's a very differing situation. Our nearest neighbour, obviously, the UK, is embarking on a huge experiment because they're opening up to the most extreme level possible, even while they're suffering a wave of cases from the Delta variant. The rest of Europe, cases are falling. Everything's calm and people are reopening. But that's because largely most countries aren't yet experienced the Delta variant, which will spread more easily. So it's hard to get a lead from international experience. So based on that, obviously, the political process and the public health officials came up with a series of scenarios, which to the public seem to differ wildly in their projections. And understandably, that's led to a lot of confusion, a lot of fear among people who are minded to be fearful, a lot of anger among people who were looking forward to being able to get back to work and get back to business very soon. So it's a messy situation. There's a lot of noise in the data and there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen in the next few weeks.
Can I ask you about this modelling and these different scenarios which are laid out? There seems to be a flaw sometimes in the way that we do our job in the media, that we always focus on the worst possible scenario. And looking as a layman at these scenarios, it seems to me that the worst possible scenario, which saw, I think, hundreds of thousands of positive cases before the end of the summer, with a consequent rise in hospitalizations and indeed a spike in deaths, I think, of somewhere over 2,000, seemed to me to be most unlikely, actually, because it'd be predicated on us doing nothing while in the midst of a fourth wave. How should we understand these kind of scenarios? How useful are they to us in understanding what the potential outcomes are?
I think, and I've experienced it myself during the pandemic, there's a natural tendency to wish to resist the bad news that they bring. However, they have proved useful in the past. I remember particularly writing a story based on an international modelling agency last spring, which claimed there would be an outlandish number of cases in Ireland and there would be repeated waves of the pandemic. And I thought, this is never going to happen. This is scaremongering stuff. But in fact, it came to pass. The prediction proved to be pretty accurate. So you're right. They do describe do-nothing situations. They are scenarios, not forecasts. In particular, last week's set of scenarios did not take account of the fact that the resumption of indoor dining was being postponed. So, the worst case won't be as bad as laid out, even as it was. We also have a tendency to focus on the big numbers, and they're the numbers of cases that might arise. That was never the best guide. You should never have relied on that only as a guide to what you should do. And even less so now that we have a lot of vaccination, widespread vaccination around the population. Cases do not translate as much as they did anywhere near as high an amount into serious illness, hospitalization, ICU admissions and death. So, you know, if you take last week's scenarios, you know, maybe the least worst one talked maybe about something like 3 deaths a day. That's not an awful lot more than we are at the moment. You know, what we really need to work out is, first of all, we have to accept that this is going to be around, this virus is going to be around in one form or another for some time to come. There's going to be flare-ups of the virus, particularly among unvaccinated sections of the population. And we've got to decide, you know, what level of existence of the virus is acceptable to society, because, you know, we're not going to eliminate it. We haven't come anywhere near, for example, the situation this time last year. You know, this time last year, you would have had maybe a handful of cases, and we've never got below 200-400 a day. So, you know, it's going to be around, and we're going to have to live with it, and we're going to have to decide what's the acceptable level of living with it. And of course, the key consideration there is, can our health service cope with it? But by now, you know, there would be an expectation among people that if it had its frailties at the beginning of 2020, they should have been ironed out by now, and there should be greater resilience in the health service to cope with waves when they do arrive.
Hugh, I think there's a point to be made as well about the impact of such protections on decision making in government. I mean, I was on duty the night that ministers were being briefed on these modelling figures and a very scary, pessimistic scenario where there could be 681,000 cases and more than 2,100 deaths. I mean, that when I first heard those figures, my initial reaction was, how could that be right? You know, and we were careful to make sure we put in the more benign projection, the optimistic projection of 81,000 cases, you know, over the 3-month period. But in the following days, trying to drill down then into, well, which of the scenarios did NPHET believe was the most likely? And it seemed to be then in the middle of two central predictions whereby there could be between 545 and 1,230 deaths over the 3-month period. And that those in themselves are very frightening numbers. But there's no doubt that ministers were taken aback when they first got the NPHET predictions. And then even the more benign scenarios or the more middle of the road scenarios are quite scary. So I guess that it definitely factored into the decision to put off the resumption of indoor hospitality services by a few weeks while they try and work out how to prove people are vaccinated.
Yeah, and Pat, in relation to that, I mean, the other thing that happened, and again, I was observing this from afar, was that there was a kind of a screeching reverse brake manoeuvre by the government, as evidenced, I think, by I was listening to Eamon Ryan speaking on the radio on Sunday about how some kind of vaccine pass to get into restaurants and bars would be divisive and not something that should be contemplated. And by Tuesday, he was saying exactly the opposite. It's kind of a tricky manoeuvre to pull off.
Yeah. Now, I note that our editorial today advises the government to be nimble and ready to make decisions and change directions on a daily or weekly basis. So perhaps the government are about to follow that advice. The Taoiseach made the point, speaking to journalists on Monday, that, and I suppose we'll come on to talk about this in a moment, but the idea of using the EU COVID pass as a ticket into, you know, bars and restaurants, that is something that the government policy is explicitly against. Now, it does seem that they are about to change it because they are examining that potential change with the representatives of the hospitality industry. There's another meeting tomorrow, and Leo Varadkar said yesterday he hopes at least to be able to bring proposals to government next week. But that does require a U-turn in government policy. And to be honest, I think that I'd agree with the sentiments in the editorial this morning that the government is going to have to, you know, is going to have to swerve and tack and jib, I think, for the next while, as the situation with regard to how the Delta variant is playing out on the ground takes shape, because as Paul says, there is a great degree of uncertainty as to how the Delta variant actually impinges on the operations of the health service and so forth. So the experience in the UK, where they're way ahead of us, both in vaccination, but also in terms of the spread of the Delta variant, has been that while cases have gone up, that hospital admissions have gone up at only a fraction of the pace, and deaths only at a fraction of what was seen elsewhere. And in a way, this is the set of decisions that confronts government within the next week, which I think is about the continuation of the restrictions that are in place on indoor dining and in some respects on other areas, is that the original idea of the restrictions and of all the restrictions going right back to, you know, the general lockdown was to protect the health service from being overrun. Now, if there is no danger of the health service being overrun, and that is the case if hospital admissions stay down despite the rise in Delta variant infections, then you would have to say, what is the rationale for keeping restrictions in place if there is no danger to the health service? So in other words, is the government about to change the rationale for restrictions from protecting the health service to simply protecting people from getting sick with this or getting infected with the virus? So in that sense, I think government is in a very difficult position at the moment because it is being pushed and pulled in several different directions with only sketchy data about what is likely to happen in terms of infections and their effect over the coming week.
Yeah, there's a couple of things, Paul, that strike me about that. One is that, and I think this is happening, it always happens when we start talking about opening up rather than closing down, the kind of the binary choice oversimplifies the questions which the government and NPHET face. It's not just a question of lockdown versus opening up, no matter what's going on in the UK. It's a more complicated set of calculations. A lot of them have to do with time. It might just be a question of buying time, 3, 4, 5 weeks to up the vaccine, I suppose, level to over 70% or 75% or something like that. And there are certain elements that, I mean, Pat talks about nimbleness in government. I mean, we don't really see that with something like the rather absurd situation we've had, which you write about in the Irish Times today, about the people stranded on one dose, the people aged between 60 and 69 of AstraZeneca jabs have been waiting for weeks. While I was talking to somebody yesterday who's been waiting for weeks for their AstraZeneca jab. In the meantime, their son has been fully vaccinated and is grand. Is in his 30s or 40s. But that'll be fixed, I gather, in the next couple of weeks. But it could have been fixed quicker. I was listening to Luke O'Neill on RTE this morning describing that as a travesty. It certainly didn't show much nimbleness, something like that, where they could have just mixed the jabs, but the system that they had in place meant that they weren't in a position to make that decision and implement it. So that doesn't fill me full of optimism about our system's nimbleness.
Yeah, I mean, it's been fixed for the system, but whether it was fixed for the people involved, it's another matter. Yeah, a few things there. It points also to the as I mentioned earlier, the complicated decision-making process with all the multiplicity of different bodies involved. Boris Johnson this week did ask a good question. He said, basically, if not now, then when? And, many scientists would say, actually, just, you know, would you just wait a little bit and then let more people be vaccinated and then maybe we'd go. But that has been a constant refrain of the scientific community. Give us a little bit more time. Extend the lockdown. And people are tired for that. I can understand that. Looking back, you could say it was justified. Certainly holding off 2 months in the spring and continuing the lockdown seemed to work in terms of stabilizing the situation and allowing everything to get on an even keel. And giving time for the vaccination program to really kick off. We're not that far, for example. Like, we've 50% of adults are fully vaccinated now, isn't it? Compared to 2/3 in Britain. So, you know, we're not that far off. So we can see what happens when you up that proportion. You still get more cases. So what are you going to do then down the line? So as you said, there is a lack of data because this is a completely new situation. We only heard of the Delta variant just before Christmas. It's only settled in this country for a few weeks. The good thing is that probably things are as bad as they can be in relation to Delta because most of our cases are Delta cases. But we're not hearing that they're more serious. The figures in England in Britain are varied. In some cases, numbers are going down. Scotland, public health officials here referenced Scotland quite a lot last week. Now, the UK has the worst figures at the moment in Europe, and Scotland have the worst figures in the UK. So, you know, they weren't picking a particularly average country. But even since then, Scotland's cases seem to have peaked and have come down. So it's really confusing scientists, both sides of the water, what exactly is going on. And of course, if you do look at the graph, which you mentioned for England, yes, the graph has gone up steeply for cases, but the other two graphs for hospitalizations and death, well, hospitalizations have gone up slightly in the last while, but deaths have completely flat. You know, and it sounds very callous to be talking about things in these terms. There are other aspects of this. You know, there is long COVID, and there's the impact on healthcare for non-COVID patients and so on that have to be factored in. But it isn't particularly reassuring to hear from the HSE that demand for services are very high at the moment. We've 300 people on trolleys every day before a possible wave comes into the hospitals.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned Scotland. I was going through the emails to our podcast email when I got back from my break, and Chris Nazel, he lives in Glasgow, he was a little bit critical about what he described as some of our sloppy language about the protection which vaccines protect. He makes a point that AstraZeneca is approximately 60% effective against infection, 80% effective against hospitalization. So that still means that, you know, that people who are vaccinated are not 100% protected. But he also makes a point, and I think Chris sent this email before the kind of developments in the UK of the last week or so, that he talks about long COVID, you know, and he says from a purely economic point of view, the long tail of people incapacitated by long COVID is something politicians and the political commentariat should be taking more seriously than they are. I mean, is that true? I'm completely at sea as to what we actually know in terms of real hard data about long COVID.
Yeah, I suppose, again, we've been looking to Britain. There was an estimate that 10% of people might have been affected by COVID, but it depends on what time period you're talking about. I think that was only 5 to 8 weeks after infection that people were still suffering the effects, which is pretty short. So you're looking at something, you know, the body of people who are affected in a serious way for a period of months after they had been infected. So I think you're talking about something about 5% of patients who are suffering symptoms still, you know, up to a year after they had been infected. And of course, some of those patients might have had very mild cases of the disease. So it's a lot of unpredictability. Some of them might have been asymptomatic. Some of the ones last year were never tested. So there's a lot of stuff being lumped in under the long COVID banner. And obviously, you know, depending on your experiences, they would very heavily colour your views on that. If you've experienced this, you know, you might take a much more profoundly serious view of it than if, you know, many doctors who speak to me say that what they're seeing tends to fade, and they're not the symptoms that are not untypical for the type of viral illness that they deal with before this pandemic started.
Cormac, what are the key pressures on inside government now at the moment? The government seems absolutely intent on following the advice of NPHET, largely to the letter, with a couple of exceptions. But presumably they're also, and in fact we can see that they're coming under pressure from those sectors of society and industries that are still completely out of action because of the restrictions. Hospitality in particular, and I suppose the tourism industry more generally, given the time of year.
Well, the key pressures, I suppose, well, the most visible and most vocal surface every Wednesday evening at parliamentary party meetings, it did last week, where Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael backbenchers were complaining about the delay in hospitality reopening indoor services. And I suspect we will have similar again tonight, and pressure on the government to come up with a plan to do what NPHET has asked, which is to provide a workable, enforceable system whereby people can show that they've been vaccinated if they want to access indoor drinking and dining in the coming months, and also do that quickly. It's speed is of the essence here now, because the hospitality industry have been arguing that if we lose most of July, the summer may as well be gone. You know, there's all these comparisons to how much business is worth in one week in the summer compared to the quiet months in autumn and winter. So you have pressure coming from within the government movement in terms of backbench TDs and outside from the industry. But I will say, I mean, you talked about a bit about buying time earlier, and certainly the decision to put off opening indoor hospitality allows for more time for more people to be vaccinated. It also allows for more time to see what happens in the UK. I mean, it's people in Britain won't thank their government if it all goes horribly wrong, this big reopening that they're happening, the dropping of pretty much every restriction in terms of hospitalizations and deaths. But in a way, Boris may have done the government here a favor as well, because while we've delayed aspects of our reopening, we can monitor what's going on in Britain in terms of the Delta and the how that spreads and the impact on hospitalizations and all the rest. So it's just an extra thing that the government will have over the coming days as they try to come to a decision on our next phase of reopening, this monitoring of the UK.
Paul, the announcements by Boris Johnson and Sajid Javid over the last few days, would it be fair at all to look at them as being a sort of retooled version of the herd immunity policy, which was discredited very early last year, but which perhaps might have some greater validity in some people's eyes at this point because of the breaking of the causal link between infections and hospitalisation?
Yeah, it certainly sounds like that, although there have been official denials of it, and people mean different things by herd immunity. Herd immunity is going to be very hard to achieve. Remember, we're only vaccinating adults at the moment, so when we give percentages, we're just talking about the adult population. Secondly, we're dealing with a variant, you know, which has an R number, a raw sort of reproduction number of 8. It's very infectious. You would have to vaccinate more than 100% of the population, basically, to get the kind of payback in terms of herd immunity. And then, you know, there are issues about whether the remainder of the population wish to be vaccinated or can be vaccinated or should be vaccinated. Those debates are still to be had. So against that, of course, obviously, we've got huge coverage with vaccines, and they are basically working. The answer to your question is, as I say, it certainly sounds like they're heading in that direction, but it is an experiment. You know, I'm not really sure what the plan B is if it doesn't work. That's the question for us.
And then, Cormac, this question of these passes, should they come to pass for getting into the pub or getting into the restaurant, it certainly seemed absurd, any idea that it would be an entirely separate process from the process the government has already embarked upon with the European pass. Why would you have two parallel processes with all the confusion and the cost that would occur? And I gather from today's newspaper that I can expect an email or maybe even a snail mail paper letter with some kind of QR code on it, which is the idea that I can just then wander down to my local pub and wave it at the door and go in for my pints? Is that the idea? That seems pretty open to, if I know anything about Irish people, that sounds pretty open to abuse.
Well, this is one of the big questions about it. How do you prove that somebody hasn't arrived down with somebody else's smartphone or somebody else's piece of paper that they've been sent with the QR code? I mean, I suppose one additional layer would be to require people to show ID alongside their COVID pass. But these are the problems that publicans and restaurateurs will be saying that, you know, firstly, it's not something they particularly want to do, but secondly, it's they're the ones that ask to police it, because from all the talk so far, it seems to be like it will very much be a self-regulating system. There's no talk at this point that the Gardaí will be involved or anything like that. But I mean, it in a way, it might well be just a few weeks of this kind of scenario where they might be relying on a COVID pass or whatever, because as more and more people are vaccinated, you know, it reduces the number of people that can't access services for a start, but also then, you know, hopefully the dire projections won't play out as had been planned. So there is an element of hope within government that this will just be a stopgap measure, whatever they come up with. But it does seem like the obvious solution to adapt the EU digital COVID certificate for this. But there are concerns about the legality of this and privacy concerns, data protection, whether does it comply with equality laws and you know, the possibility people could claim they've been discriminated against. So these are issues that government is looking at and the Attorney General is examining at the moment. It's unclear whether that advice will be ready before tomorrow's meeting with the hospitality industry. But I think, as Pat mentioned earlier, the goal is to have some sort of a workable or proposal in place at least by early next week, so that it can be discussed at Cabinet.
Last question on this, Pat. I was on my holidays in Donegal. Donegal is the, I think, probably is the highest level of positivity for COVID in the country at the moment, very largely because it's a border county and the border is entirely permeable. I was listening to a Vox Pop in Buncrana on RTE Radio last week. And what was interesting to me about it was that most of the people really didn't seem that bothered about COVID anymore. They didn't think it was that serious. There didn't really be a sense that life was at danger. And basically, there was a kind of, how would you ever get off our backs kind of a response there. And I wonder, is that a harbinger of how people at large are going to start thinking more and more about COVID?
This is a really interesting question. I think you, and I'm interested you should say that, because I saw similar patterns in the Department of Health research, which was published the other day. This is the ongoing research on public attitudes to COVID and restrictions and so forth that they publish every week. Now, previously, when we have been facing into another wave, the public has become a bit more frightened of COVID in advance of that wave. In other words, the public has tended to be, if you track the data of the public's perception of where we are, the public has tended to be a bit ahead of what has actually subsequently happened and subsequently showed up in the COVID numbers and then in government actions. And while there are some indications that people are becoming a little bit more pessimistic about the future, there is also indications in it that people are becoming those people, and there's always been, you know, the two groups of people who are less fearful of COVID and people who are more fearful of COVID in the population. But those who are, the number of people who are impatient with the relaxing of the restrictions is growing a little. It's not diminishing. So if that continues, then I think what you're looking at is probably a majority of people who will be saying, look, let's get on with it. And this is in tune with our own poll findings from the spring and early summer, which tended to show that if people, once that people's attitude, and these were taken in a completely different context, of course, but when people believed that when the vulnerable people had been vaccinated, when the vaccine had been rolled out, that they wanted life to get back to normal at that stage. So in summary, I think that what you witnessed in Donegal last week on an anecdotal basis, there may be reason to believe that that is reflected across the country at large. And if it is, I think it's an important shift in public opinion.
Right. We should leave the subject of COVID there for today. And I'll thank Paul for joining us before we move on to our next topic. And so Cormac and Pat are still with us because we have the pressing subject, or always a pressing subject for political correspondence, which is we have a by-election this week, Pat. The Dublin Bay South by-election takes place on Thursday and count day is Friday. Looking forward to it?
Of course. What better way to spend an afternoon for political correspondence than down in the RDS, watching the piles of ballot paper stack up and trying to look at your crystal ball and see what it means for the seventh count. I think it'll be really interesting. You know, real uncertainty as to what sort of turnout you're going to get. Turnout in Dublin Bay South has tended to be on the low side. Some of that, I think, is because of the transient nature of the population in some parts of that constituency, which probably inflate the electoral register and thus depress the turnout figures. But, you know, talking to people on the various campaigns yesterday, they are all now looking to, you know, to put in a big get out the vote effort. Particularly Fine Gael will be doing a big get out the vote effort tomorrow to get its voters to the polls, in the belief that if it can get its voters to turn out, its candidate James Gagan will stay far enough ahead of Ivana Bacic to make her uncatchable. The evidence of our poll would suggest that that race will be pretty tight. And if there is, to the extent that we can judge any momentum from a series of anecdotal reports on the canvas, there does appear to be some momentum behind Ivana Bacic. And the conventional wisdom of the oft wrong conventional wisdom, but for what it's worth, the conventional wisdom amongst most political observers and political pundits seems to be that that Ivana Bacic will do well enough on first preferences to make her overhauling of James Gagan an inevitability. I wouldn't be that confident, but I would say that is the probable outcome at this stage.
And Cormac, you've been out with some of the candidates this week, including Ivana Bacic. So what's your read of how she's performing?
Well, everyone enjoyed, you know, canvassing in the sunshine. And I checked the weather for tomorrow, scattered showers, so it shouldn't dictate too much against its turnout. But one thing I was wondering is, I noticed as we were going around both Milltown with Ivana Bacic and Ratgar with Claire Byrne, was despite the work from home orders and the COVID situation, a lot of people not at home, actually. I suspected that maybe there's holiday homes in the West getting use at the moment and things like that. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see what the turnout is tomorrow, given that Sinn Féin had one of its greatest by-election successes in a scenario where there's very low turnout in Dublin Midwest in 2019, getting Mark Ward elected because of their very strong Get Out the Vote campaign on that occasion. But to return to Ivana Bacic on the doors, I mean, she was getting the campaigns always say it, you know, there's never been a single campaign team that never said they didn't get a positive reaction on the doors, but she genuinely did in what was considered to be quite a Fine Gael area of Milltown. There were indeed Fine Gael supporters who said that they were likely to vote for her, a Fianna Fáil supporter as well, for that matter, albeit one of her former teachers. So they may have always been voting for her, but Labour definitely did have a pep in their step after that that poll that showed them on 22%, and the former TD Kevin Humphreys, you know, kind of an experienced voice from that constituency. I mean, he went as far as to say that, you know, it's possible she could top the poll. He certainly thinks it's going to be very tight between her and James Gagan when it comes down to it. He said as few as 200 and 500 votes, so it could be a bit of a nail biter on Friday as the counts come in. And if it is particularly tight, I mean, you couldn't discount the possibility of recounts and things like that, meaning a result could drag on late into the evening, or God forbid, Saturday morning perhaps either. But that's certainly the wind is in Ivana Bacic's sails, but it all depends on how well Fine Gael can get their core support out in a constituency, remember, that used to have, that had two Fine Gael TDs not that long ago. It'd be quite extraordinary if they didn't return if they didn't have a single TD in Dublin Bay South for the remainder of this Dáil.
Well, indeed. And if Ivana Bacic were to top the poll, she would undoubtedly win the seat, I think, Pat. The question is, she needs to be within hailing distance of him, which I take to be about 5% or so after the first count. I saw a commentator in another newspaper suggesting that if James Gagan doesn't hit 30% on the first count, he's in trouble. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I wouldn't quibble with that. Yeah. You know, look, of course, we had the poll last week, but that was taken, you know, a long time before many people would have begun to focus in on that. But taking that as our base, and there's a bit of a, you know, a decent lead for Gagan in that poll. If that was reflected on the day, I think if that poll was reflected exactly on the day, and of course it won't be, but were it to be reflected exactly on the day, I think it would be tight, but I think Ivana Bacic would take it. You're right, if he gets to 30%, and Ivana Bacic is around the 22% that she was in the poll, then the odds would swing to Gagan, I think. But most people who have been out and just talking from people across the campaigns think it will be closer than that. And of course, we're all operating in a, you know, an information vacuum apart from the poll. But I think the feeling of most people, and the feeling of most people is often confounded in these things. But it is that Gagan is, you know, he needs to get to 30%. He needs her not to get up to 25% if he's going to have enough to hang on.
And is there some possibility that the media coverage and indeed our own poll, which framed it as a two-horse race between those two candidates, there are, of course, many others, you know, many of them coming in at around 10%, Fianna Fáil and the Greens, slightly surprisingly low Sinn Féin number, I thought, in our poll, 13%, down from 16% at the general election. But that if it's coalescing into a two-horse race, that some of those other votes might go to Batchik as the anti-government candidate, I suppose.
Well, yes, I think soft anti-government votes will certainly go to Batchik. Will Sinn Féin votes go to Batchik? I'd wonder about that. I mean, she was coming out yesterday saying, look, you know, this, and we reported in our paper this morning, you know, this isn't about getting rid of the government, which is, of course, exactly what Sinn Féin want to do. She said this is a way of sending a message to the government about certain policies, which is as polite a way of expressing opposition as you can possibly get. And don't forget that this is a constituency where, you might expect intuitively, and certainly our poll bore out, this isn't a constituency that is hostile to this government. There's a majority of people in this constituency that are satisfied with the way the government is doing. So there is a possibility of intra-government transfers. And our poll suggested that there should be a fairly strong transfer of votes from Fianna Fáil to Fine Gael. And you'd wonder, you know, will you see that intra-government transfer replicated in the Green votes? And, you know, if assuming all the time that, you know, the Greens and Fianna Fáil go out at a relatively early stage, that could, you know, those votes could go to, some of those votes could go to Fine Gael, or at least the intra-government solidarity, if that's what turns out to be evident once the votes are counted, could retard the expected strong transfer of votes to Ivana Batchik. So, I don't think this is by any means a nailed down certainty at all yet. It will be really important, the gap, if there is a gap between Gagan and Batchik on the first count, will be the first thing to look for as an indication of where things are going. And if there is a small gap, then we may be able to call this relatively early.
Yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Claire Byrne may be a member of a party of government. I know you were out with her this week, Cormac, but I expect her transfers to go fairly significantly to Ivana Batchik, who kind of occupies quite a similar kind of political brand sort of space.
Absolutely. I mean, she says herself that her second preference has always gone to Labour and will do so again on this occasion. You'd have to suspect that the Social Democrats transfers from Sarah Durkan would also benefit Ivana Batchik, as well as some of the smaller parties and independents in the race. So it's likely to be very close. But it's one thing that you know, noticed on the door as well, is that the Cate O'Connell's name came up, the former Fine Gael TD who had a falling out with the party leadership and with many in the constituency locally as well. But if James Gagan isn't successful in keeping that seat vacated by Owen Murphy for Fine Gael, there will be serious questions asked as to why bridges couldn't be mended with Cate O'Connell, because she would have, as a former TD in the area who very narrowly missed out during the general election, she would have had a very good chance of getting over the line for Fine Gael. So expect those sort of questions to be asked if things go wrong for Leo Varadkar's party.
Right, well, we'll be covering the count, of course, on irishtimes.com throughout the day on Friday, and we'll do a special podcast, hopefully when the dust is beginning to clear and we maybe get a sense. When do you think that might happen, Pat? Is that a dangerous prediction as to when we might not have a concrete result, but clear indications of how things are panning out?
Yes, it's always a risky prediction to make, but I was speaking to somebody yesterday who will be involved in the count, and they're pretty bullish about, you know, their preparations. They say that COVID shouldn't retard the production of the result. They are hoping for first counts at around lunchtime and maybe to have the whole thing wrapped up by mid to late afternoon. And for those of us who like to have a cool beer on a Friday night, that would be indeed a welcome outcome.
Indeed, I might see you for one of those outdoors, of course. We shall leave it there. Thanks very much indeed to Pat and to Cormac and to Paul Cullen for joining us earlier. Thanks also to our producer, Jennifer Ryan, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We will be back very soon indeed. Indeed, on Friday, we will be with you. And do remember that you can mail us with your thoughts and your questions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taking to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.